You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. I'm Darrell West, Vice President of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, and I'd like to welcome you to our event on the role of the Postal Service in the 2020 election. The Post Office has moved to the forefront of our national discussion about because of concerns about voting by mail, equipment removals, overtime restrictions, and funding shortfalls. Many worry that without sufficient resources, the Post Office will not be able to handle are expected doubling in voting by mail this year. I have a piece on the Brookings website about the mechanics of voting by mail, and people can read that at brookings.edu. In addition, there's concern that many Americans will not receive timely delivery of food, medicine, and packages. There's a fear that that will have real-life consequences for people all across the country. In the last week, there have been hearings by the House and Senate with Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, and their legislators quizzed him on his operational decisions and whether the post office will be up to the job of delivering the votes by election day. Many worry about cost cutting right before the November election that could undermine service delivery and create problems for the voting process. To help us think about these issues, we're delighted to have two distinguished experts to discuss these issues. Elaine Kmark is director of the Center for Effective Public Management, and she's written extensively about public management and the operation of federal agencies. And she has a great project rating the states on their election processes. Camille Bousset is director of our Race, Prosperity, and Inclusion Initiative and the editor of the How We Rise blog. She writes about ways to achieve greater racial equity in the United States, and everyone should check out her blog for insightful analysis and recommendations on how to move forward. And for those of you who are watching, if you have questions, you can email them to us at events.brookings.edu. That's events@brookings.edu, or you can post the questions on Twitter at #election2020. So, Elaine, I'd like to start with you. How worried are you about the ability of the post office to deliver the votes by election day?
Well, thanks, Darrell. I am worried, okay, but I'm not hysterical, not yet, okay? And let me give you four reasons why I think we might be okay. First of all, is that we had a trial run, which were all the primaries that happened throughout this year and are still happening. States learned a lot of stuff in that trial run. First and foremost, the importance of keeping in-person polling places open during elections, even if there are a large number of absentee ballot requests. So I think that states are in a learning mode right now. They've been learning throughout the primary. Number two is we caught Donald Trump. We caught Louis DeJoy in obviously trying to diminish post office capacity right before an election. And I think Congress acted swiftly. I think the states acted swiftly. There's lawsuits going forward. And DeJoy pulled back on some of the measures that he was doing. And I think that maybe is just in the nick of time. Third is there have been and there continue to be some fail-safe measures built into the election system. One is that in addition to mailing your ballot back, lots of jurisdictions have places where you can drop off your ballot. And I think given all the paranoia that's been created by the Trump administration, a lot of people who are absentee voters may not trust the mail. They may go drive to the drop-off place, which even in a pandemic is a safe thing to do. The other fail-safe measure is that some states are moving towards counting ballots 5 days or up to 10 days after they've been received, as long as they're postmarked on election night. So that also gives a little bit of leeway. If your if the mail takes a long time, in some states it will still be counted. And finally is the basic issue of capacity. The post office handles 472 million pieces of mail every single day. And if we assume that this is a massive turnout in November, we're talking about 140, 145 million votes. My estimates and other estimates from the primaries are that as many as 50% of those might involve the mail in some way. But so think about it in perspective. We're talking about, say, 70 to 72.5 million pieces of extra mail over a 3-week period of time in a system which regularly handles 472 million pieces a day. So if we have stopped the diminishment in USPS capacity, they certainly ought to be able to handle the number of ballots that we will be seeing in November. So that's why I say I'm cautiously optimistic, but that's largely because people have been watching and have been paying attention to the vote, and I think responding in ways to make us safer.
Well, I like your optimism and certainly hope that you are right on Election Day. But I am concerned about the disparate impact on various groups and communities across America. And Camille, I know you devote a lot of attention to looking at racial and geographic disparities. How could some of the postal cuts that have been undertaken affect voting by various groups in the United States?
Well, hi, Daryl and Elaine. And again, welcome to everyone who has joined us for this discussion. You know, what I think is interesting about this current controversy over the USPS is that the changes that Postmaster DeJoy put in place, which have led to real delays in mail delivery, I think have been interpreted as a small part of the long history of voter suppression, particularly of Black and brown votes. And I think while it's unclear how the actual changes that he put in place and the ones that he might not necessarily roll back might play out during the election for Black and brown voters, voter suppression tactics are not new for communities of color. There's obviously been a very long history, poll taxes, reading tests, et cetera. And, you know, I think for areas with large communities of color, I think people are aware of these tactics, may have experienced them most recently during the primaries, most recent primaries. And for those folks, you know, voting early in person and in significant numbers is likely to overwhelm any attempts at manipulation. But that said, I think where I think postal delays might have more consequence will be in places where voting by absentee ballot is relatively new or newly widespread, and where the deadlines for requesting ballots and some of the requirements around proper signatures might not be well understood. And it strikes me that absent really excellent tutorials by state election officials, many in these kinds of jurisdictions might find themselves without sufficient time to mail in their ballots or to request the ballot early enough to make state deadlines. So that's kind of where I see things heading at the moment.
And there certainly are a number of states that have experience with absentee ballots, but given the fact that we're expecting a doubling in the population that's going to vote via the mail, there's interesting questions about whether the volume is going to create problems. And Camille, as you point out, there are states that don't have a lot of experience with that, and that could certainly be an issue for them. For each of you, I just want to ask a question. The Postmaster General has said that he is not going to rescind any of the changes that already have been implemented, and he's not going to reinstall the equipment that already has been taken out. What should states and localities be doing to mitigate any possible consequences of those decisions? Elaine, maybe we'll start with you.
Well, that's a difficult question, okay, because the states and localities don't have much control there. But there are some things that the states can do. I mean, Camille mentioned states doing tutorials on how to vote absentee and make sure people do it often. We often forget that the driving forces in telling people how to vote are the two political parties. They're the ones that have the most interest in getting out the vote. So I would expect, given the high intensity of this election, given the fact that both parties will have massive amounts of money to spend in this election, that there will be a lot of voter education, just plain old voter education going on by the political parties to make sure that people are getting their requesting their ballot on time, et cetera. I also think that one of the things states can do is, and this is also goes into the fail-safe category, is they have got to keep in-person voting places open, particularly in neighborhoods where there are high numbers of persons of color. They've got to keep those polling places open. And the reason is that that's your fail-safe. If your ballot doesn't arrive on time, if it's not sitting on your desk and the dog eats your ballot, there's all sorts of things that can happen. And if something happens and election day comes, you can still go to a polling place. The states made the mistake in the primaries of seeing all these requests for absentee ballots and saying, oh, look, everybody's going to vote absentee. We can reduce our number of polling places. That turned out to be a real problem in Baltimore, in places in Maryland, in Atlanta, in Philly, in Louisville, Kentucky. That turned out to be a real problem. People stood in line for hours and hours. So I think the states, I mean, you know what the bureaucratic thinking is quite correct. They say, well, wait a minute, why should we spend the money to keep all these polling places open if everybody's going to vote by mail? But the fact of the matter is they've got to keep those places open because that is the safety valve in the system.
That certainly is an important point, and you're exactly right. During the primaries, there were a number of states that had very long lines at their in-person polling places because of decisions that they made. Camille, your thoughts on what states and localities should be doing to mitigate possible problems?
Sure. I mean, I would agree with Elaine, and I would just add a couple of sort of points for context. You know, the Postal Service has been preparing for expanded vote by mail for months, and even before the coronavirus pandemic, even before DeJoy took office as the nation's postmaster general in June, the agency began its outreach to election administrations in March, and hundreds of election mail coordinators regionally, and consulting with state and county officials on everything from the dates that they plan to send the ballots out to the design of the envelopes themselves. And of course, we know that last month the Postal Service sent letters to election administrators and a variety of states, warning them that their deadlines for requesting and returning mail ballots may be incongruous with the Postal Service delivery standards. So of all the ways to prevent, slow mail from disenfranchising voters, I think realistic state deadlines are among those that the administration, for instance, cannot influence. And states should pursue the necessary legislative and administrative changes urgently, to make sure that that's in place. And then I just want to, I want to say something about postal workers. You know, postal workers are voters too. And for years, they've been trained to prioritize ballots at election time. And so in addition to what states might do and localities might do, to some degree, I think postal workers will also be able to mitigate and prevent many of the issues that we foresee or anticipate that might, pop up. I mean, that's not to say that they can protect against all issues, but I think that there are some additional fail safes there as well.
Can I just add one thing to that? Because Camille brought up the postal workers. There's a 1993 law that requires a special logo and a special barcode on ballots. And postal workers have for years, they've pulled those ballots out. So even if they are stamped as third class mail, they have pulled them out and often delivered them as first class mail. And so as long as the DeJoy doesn't try to prevent that, I expect they'll do the same thing this time around because they are, as Camille said, they're voters too.
So Elaine, Camille mentioned the voter issue. What should voters do? Any advice on how they can safeguard their vote? We know that in some states, our early voting is going to start as early as mid-September. So that's just a few weeks away now. Any advice for voters?
I think the best advice for voters is to make sure you know when your ballot has to be accepted. Okay, so for instance, in California, you can put your ballot in the mail on election day. And if as long as it arrives within 5 days, which is pretty safe, 2 to 4 days is first class mail averages. If it arrives in 5 days, it will be counted. But there are other states where the ballot has to arrive on election day. And you've got to figure that out state by state. In fact, if you want to, you can go to the Brookings website and look at our vote by mail scorecard and look up your state, and it'll show you what the situation is. So if you're going to vote absentee, you just got to make sure that you know when your ballot has to be in. I also think early voting, which has gotten much, much more popular, is a really good option for people who know who they're going to vote for and who are not going to go to, who don't want to use an absentee ballot. Because early voting, usually I've voted early here in Massachusetts, and usually, you know, you go in and just nobody's there and you fill out your ballot and that's it. And you wear your mask and it's not very dangerous at all. So those are two things. And then the third thing is that, and this is, by the way, often count at the county level, county discretion, not even state, just make sure that there are a sufficient number of polling places still open. We're not going to have the same number that we did in 2016 because, in fact, the number of early voting and absentee is going up. But we've got to have more than we had in the primaries because that really did not work.
Yeah, that point about early voting is important. I think a lot of people don't understand that in a number of states, you can actually vote early in person, meaning that polling places are open in certain jurisdictions, several weeks in advance of the actual election day. So if people are worried about the mail and, you know, is their ballot going to get there in time, that's a way to vote in person, but before election day. Camille, your thoughts on the voter angle and any advice on what voters can do to safeguard their votes?
You know, I would agree with both of you. I think paying attention, obviously, to the requirements in your particular state and voting early, either through absentee ballot or in person, I think are really the keys. But, you know, one of the things I think that's really interesting about this controversy is that now everybody is all of a sudden focused on how am I going to get my vote to count, right? And so I think the controversy has had this unintended but positive consequence of, you know, focus on the actual mechanics of voting. Which I think, you know, to be honest, I think most Americans probably didn't give a lot of thought to, you know, prior to hearing either from President Trump or from Postmaster General DeJoy during the House and Senate hearings, that there were some, you know, potential issues. And so I do think this is actually, I think actually this could be very positive.
So, Elaine, you mentioned the issue of mail ballots. And, of course, President Trump has been railing against mail ballots, saying the election is going to be rigged. There's going to be massive fraud. How worried are you about mail ballots, the fraud issue, and some of the logistical issues associated with voting by mail?
Well, first of all, there are five states that have voted by mail in the past, and we can look at the history of those states. And when we look at the history of those states, we find no instances of fraud. Okay. It's just not, major fraud is just not there. There's a piece on the Brookings website again that I wrote not too long ago where we took Heritage Foundation data. For those of you who don't know, Heritage is a very conservative, aligned with the Republican Party think tank. They went through and they tried to find all the instances of voter fraud in vote by mail states. And it was really interesting. Their data showed that, for instance, in the state of Oregon, there were 15 cases of voter fraud in their mail by ballot, universal mail-in ballot system over a period of two decades and 15 million votes cast. We have never seen an instance of widespread voter fraud in a mail-in ballot state. And the number of mail-in ballot states have gone from 5 to 9 in this election cycle. And I don't expect there to be much there. This notion President Trump has that foreign governments are going to print lots of ballots and mail them to everybody, it's just nonsense. I mean, the states know the kind of paper that they printed on. The ballots are barcoded. The ballots are sent in a certain format. I mean, it would be really, really, really unusual and really hard for China to decide to print Cuyahoga County, Ohio's ballots. I mean, it's just not going to happen. Okay. So the fraud issue has been a real red herring in this whole debate. I worry less about fraud than I do about the sort of things we've been talking about, just the bureaucratic snafus, just the problem of volume. Those, I think, are much more serious than the issue of fraud.
Yeah, people do need to distinguish fraud from simple incompetence. There always is incompetence in our election process just because it's very decentralized and involves millions of people. That doesn't mean there is going to be fraud. The military has been voting by mail for years without any problems. Camille, your thoughts on mail ballots. How worried are you about those, and what are the logistical things we should be worrying about?
So I would agree with Elaine. I mean, there's just no evidence of, you know, fraud for mail-in ballots. I don't even think it actually deserves a lot of consideration, except that it has been part of the national, conversation, but there's just no evidence there. It's nothing compelling at all there. Where I would say, I think, are a few more areas for, questions to arise, and I'm sure they will, is, as you mentioned, the logistics, right? And this is not just the mail-in ballots, but it's the ones who, the absentee ballots, whether they're dropped off or they're mailed in, you know, they have to go through a number of hands, and there's got to be some counting and manual counting and manual consideration of signatures and validating, you know, addresses and things like that. And, there are some opportunities there, I think, either intentional or unintentional, for some ballots to be discarded or thrown out or, not considered valid. And so, if I were a betting person, I would say the likelihood of things cropping up in that sort of, supply chain from getting the ballot in to actually recording a vote, I think there's probably slightly higher chance of things happening there that, might be challenged than any possibility of fraud by mail-in and ballot.
Yeah, it seems like one of the important logistical considerations is on this issue that, Camille, you just mentioned, in terms of signature verification, because that is one of the safeguards that is built in. So when you vote via the mail, you sign the back of the envelope. It goes to the local election authorities. They have your signature on file. They can compare the two. But then local officials also have pretty broad leeway in terms of disqualifying ballots because they think the signature doesn't match up. And so, Elaine, first with you, of course, we remember all the balloting problems from the 2000 election, Bush and Gore, the election with the famous hanging chads. I'm wondering if this year, are we going to move from hanging chads to poorly written signatures creating problems, and there being lots of challenges on the verification side of the signatures?
Oh, I think we could. And the answer to that, Daryl, is even broader, because it's an answer to a lot of these things. If there is a landslide in one direction or the other, then none of this stuff's really going to matter. Okay. Typically in some states, they even stop counting the absentee ballots and announce a winner when the margins just get so big that one person has clearly carried the state. If, however, it's close, then every single thing matters. And you're exactly right. We may be in a situation, if some state in the presidential is very close, or a Senate race or a congressional race is close, where the state will mark these ballots where they think the signatures don't match as provisional. Now, in some states, as soon as your vote is a problem, they tell you, right? And allow you to come back and say, yes, I really did vote. I really did vote for this person and a bunch of other stuff. Some states, however, they don't even tell you. And that's actually a problem. But look, if this is close in any state, in any race, we will have hanging chads and we will have lots of signature disputes, date disputes, everything.
So Camille, I'm curious your thoughts on this signature issue, because it seems like there are opportunities for mischief on that part of it. Like, I've seen data from some states broken down by county level, and there's tremendous variation in signature disqualifications. So in some counties, there are very few signatures that get disqualified. In other counties, there are larger numbers, two or three times the percent. So is this something we should be watching? Is this a potential area where if there are going to be shenanigans, this could be where it happens?
Yeah, I definitely think so. And I think some, areas are more prone to having these kinds of issues than others. You know, we know, having looked at the most recent primaries and then also the 2018 elections, that, for instance, Georgia and Florida continue to just be kind of the poster children for not being the most competent in being able to count votes, count them in a timely manner, and also in validating ballots that end up turning out to be qualified ballots. So I think, there is a potential for some mischief there. I think, I would watch again those states where they do not have an unblemished record. And so I think there's, you talked a little bit earlier about kind of disparate impact. And I do think this is where you might see disparate impact and where we have seen it before. Because some of the tactics that are used in validating ballots are also, they're pretty congruent with voter suppression tactics that some states have employed or some counties have employed, those tactics, including aggressive voter roll purging, polling site closures, uneven voting resource allocations. And we can add to that the way in which ballots are viewed and validated. So I think that could just be part of a pattern that could have disparate impact. I think one of the ways to manage that, as Elaine alluded to, is, you can actually challenge those signature and address determinations, but you do need to know about it. And so I do think there'll be a lot of activity around monitoring, how those validations and determinations are made. But the other thing that I want to raise here is, I think in this election, and I think this is actually really important, the way ballots might be handled in places that do not have a history of voter suppression, I think is actually really interesting, because I think subjective enforcement in precincts and counties where you have really thin margins could add up to narrow victories for either candidate. And so, I'm thinking here about small counties in Wisconsin and Michigan, et cetera. These are not places that are, have a history necessarily of voter suppression, but that kind of subjective enforcement of some of the rules around, what the signatures look like, et cetera, is certainly, certainly something that could come up. And those could, given the sort of electoral college math, those could be very, very significant. They could end up being material. So, I just think this is, I just don't think mail-in ballots are really, there's no fraud issue there, but I think that sort of this, what happened when you get ballots that now you have to look at signatures and do some validation, I think that's where we may have some questions, and I'm sure, there'll be a lot of challenges and lawsuits as we move forward in the election process.
I mean, it does seem like both parties are preparing for possible litigation on election day or shortly thereafter over various issues that are coming up with mail ballots. So one type of legal issue is just, you know, how particular jurisdictions handle the mail ballot rules. Like, did they interpret their rules properly? Did they apply them? But there's a broader consideration, which came up in Bush versus Gore, which is what happens if states employ different criteria in judging mail ballots and in verifying signatures and in verifying the addresses. Could states be open to equal protection lawsuits alleging that people in one state didn't have the same protection as people in other states because there were different rules or different ways in which the rules were being applied, and that could then become a basis to disqualify certain types of votes? So I guess it kind of raises the question whether each of you expect, is this election ultimately going to be decided by the courts if it is a close race?
Well, if it's a close race, it might be decided by the courts, although the courts, you know, have a very long history of trying to stay out of elections, period. And with the exception of Bush v. Gore, which has gotten a lot of, you know, criticism from legal scholars and constitutional scholars. Also, the Constitution is quite explicit about voting and elections being in the, that's a state business. So, you know, the Constitution has always given states a lot of leeway in how they want to run their elections. I go back to an earlier point. When the ballots are being counted, when the absentee ballots are being counted in those rooms, and often they're centralized, they're not little local rooms, there is a representative of each political party in the room. And again, the adversarial nature of that means that if there is in the counting or in the judgment, oh, this ballot's bad and we think it comes from this neighborhood and that's why we're going to throw it out, I suspect unless the political party representatives are totally asleep at the wheel, that they're running to court right away. Right. If they see evidence of that, they're going to run to court. You know, 4 years ago, the political parties had upwards of 50,000 lawyers mobilized just for Election Day. So everybody's ready and everybody's watching. And they don't want this to be a mess. They want it to be, they're checking each other all the time. And of course, the election officials are right smack in the middle of it. So they have an incentive not to be brought into court. So there's a lot of actors in this game that are looking over the shoulder of the election officials.
Camille, your thoughts on the legal angle and the possibility that the courts may end up deciding this?
Well, you know, I would largely agree with Elaine. I mean, you know, if it's very close, obviously, you know, the courts are going to try to stay out of it and they're going to try to have the process work out without actually getting involved. But, you know, we could get there. It is a possibility, you know, but I also think that state election officials are probably at this moment working very, very hard to ensure that their state is not the poster child for election incompetence and, you know, and very long litigation and court judgment. So I think they, you know, election officials have an incentive in general to try to make sure that their ship is pretty tight. And I think particularly for this election, because as, you know, Elaine has mentioned, I mean, both sides are so lawyered up that, you know, within seconds of something looking a little bit irregular, there will be, you know, some sort of litigation filed. So, you know, I think, you know, my guess is that there will be some close states and maybe close precincts, and there you may see some legal action. But I think overall, for the overall election and for the Electoral College in general, I think we'll pretty much know relatively soon after the election, you know, what the result is without a whole lot of movement through the courts.
Okay, so on this question of when we're actually going to know, so of course Americans are used to actually getting projections on, you know, as the votes roll in on election night, and then kind of late on election night, we know who the winner is going to be. In this election, I'm wondering, whether it's going to take a few days or maybe even a few weeks to actually get the results. Just between, if a lot of people vote via mail ballots, which is what we're expecting, it could take states days, if not longer, to count those ballots. In the California primary this year, for example, I think it was 3 or 4 days after the election before we actually got the results. If there are any of these legal issues concerning signature verification, that could take a while to litigate. And so what I'm wondering is, it seems like people are going to need to adjust their expectations for election night in light of likely scenarios. So my question is kind of getting at the news media angle. Do you have any advice for reporters and perhaps for the rest of us in terms of how we should think about election day? And I know, Elaine, you've talked about it's actually election week, or some people have said election month. How should they be helping to prepare the American public for some of the scenarios that could develop that are not the kinds of scenarios we have seen in the past? Elaine, you want to start
with that? Yeah, I want to start with, I think it could be election week, at least for some races, maybe not for the presidential. We may know that a little earlier, but certainly for some contested Senate races and House races, it could be election week. But I think the most important players in this are the producers at the major networks and cable stations. They need to take a deep breath and stop the race to call the election until they have really, really good data. And what is likely to happen, given the nonsense that Trump has spewed about mail-in ballots, is we already see in polling that Republicans are going to vote in person and Democrats are going to vote by mail. So your election night vote could be very unrepresentative of the total vote as it's counted. And the networks and CNN and Fox and everybody has to be responsible. Now, in the past, the way the networks have predicted a state is they've had two basic metrics. The exit polling from the day of the election, where, you know, they ask a couple people as they're coming out, a sample of people, who'd you vote for, et cetera. And the other thing that they've had is they've had past election history of that precinct. They've had key precincts, and those key precincts are interesting. Well, key precincts are out the window this time, because in fact, the mail-in ballots don't come in by precinct, right? They generally go to the state to a central place. So you're not going to really have any sense of key precincts the way we used to have. So that metric is gone. On the other hand, in some states, they actually keep a public list of people as they voted absentee, not how they voted, but just that they did vote. So in some states, the pollsters for the networks are going to be able to sample people who voted absentee. And frankly, if they have a decent sample of election day voters and a decent sample of early vote and absentee, they can probably be pretty close in calling a state, unless it's one of these, you know, hanging by a hair. So it's going to be really, it's a whole different methodology that they're developing. And I have a piece on this on the Brookings website, so you can read about it. There's a whole different methodology for predicting election night. And the bottom line is that the television has to behave itself, or else they're going to throw a pall over our democracy, no matter who wins.
But that concerns me right there. You're saying television needs to behave itself. You know, we have a very polarized media where Fox, CNN, and MSNBC, as along with the networks, may move in very different directions. Just this morning, I heard Hillary Clinton give Joe Biden advice, like, don't concede the election on election night if it looks like you're losing, because it may be that the in-person voting, as Elaine pointed out, is tilted in favor of Republicans, but the mail ballots are going to be tilted in favor of Democrats. So it may look that Trump is winning early, and he may end up losing later. Camille, your thoughts on election night scenarios and what we should be worrying about, and any advice for reporters on how to cover this?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I have advice for both reporters and for voters. So, you know, I would agree with Elaine that there just has to be a very different coverage formula for the networks. And I think the usual sort of frenzy and buildup, I think, is really going to be misplaced and is going to look odd and awkward in this election. So I do think it's going to be important for the networks to explain to voters that actually in this election, you know, we have votes coming in sort of sequence, and what proportion of the votes for what state are actually in person and what are actually, you know, mail-in ballots, so that people really understand that there is a difference this time. And so I think that's going to be really important. And I think, you know, rushing to judgment or trying to find votes and trying to use precinct data is all, you know, it might help keep eyeballs, you know, on the network, but I don't think it'll be very helpful at all. And I think in the end, you know, networks will be panned if they utilize that same formula. So,
So one last question for you before we take some questions from the audience, yeah. And that is the role of the candidates, Trump versus Biden on election night, in terms of, you know, if you have the in-person voting going more Republican, the absentee ballots going more Democratic, what's this going to mean for Trump and how he plays it? What's it going to mean for Biden and how he should play it?
Well, I'll just start off and say, you know, I do think that it's just constitutionally really difficult for President Trump to not want to step in and make some pronouncements either via tweet or otherwise. And so I expect to see a bit of a spectacle there and with Biden sort of counseling patience and that sort of thing. And, you know, my advice to either candidate would be, you know, just hold your horses and let's just let the process play out. And I would say to, you know, to voters in general, you know, we've had a lesson in patience with COVID-19. And to me, this is just going to be one more example of how we have to sort of reset our expectations in the age of the pandemic. We will have a result and we will be able to swear in a president on January 21st, 2021. And I think that's the bottom line.
Elaine, your thoughts on that?
I mean, she's absolutely right. We need to be patient and we need to tell our neighbors and our friends, just be patient. And I want to bring you back. There's an interesting irony here. Daryl and I have studied the election disinformation, wrote a short book on it last summer. And, you know, before the pandemic happened, we were all worried about Russian interference in the election. We were worried about them hacking into state election systems and you know, screwing up the vote count, et cetera. Well, what did states do in response to this worry? States started to adopt paper ballots in the digital age, right? Sometimes the states you could vote electronically, but then it would issue a paper ballot you'd sign and the state would take care of it in case of a recount or in case somebody interfered with the software of the election process. So we were going in the direction of paper ballots as a safety measure against election interference. And that was happening, and then the pandemic happened. So one of the ironies here is that while it may take a long time, we may have a very much more accurate vote and a much more safe vote if a lot of these votes are in fact in paper ballots, which is what an absentee or an early vote is.
I mean, I like the fact that both of you are advising patience on election night. But I do have to point out, we are not a patient society and our technology is not patient. This is the age of Twitter when we all overreact instantly to tiny little nuggets. So that's a thing that I would worry about on election night. So let's move to some questions from the audience. We're starting to get a number of questions, both about the post office angle as well as the mail balloting question. So Robert has a question on the post office part of this. He wants to know, is there any way for Congress or particular states to force the return of some of the sorting equipment that has been removed from post offices?
I think that that's probably pretty difficult. The House did a couple Saturdays ago, the House came into a special session. They passed a $25 billion bill. In that bill, they said you can't do certain things, like you can't stop overtime, et cetera. But frankly, these are things that have already happened. I'm not sure that they can put those back together again. Now, the bill did require the post office to stop closing processing centers. So presumably processing centers that are open, and DeJoy, you know, kind of said at least that he's going to, you know, comply with these. So I don't think we're going to see any more. But, you know, remember, part of the problem here is that the post office does do these things on a regular basis. They do take mailboxes out if they think they're being underutilized. They do close processing centers when there isn't that much mail in a certain region. So they are doing this. It's a little bit hard to separate out what they're doing that's just normal business and adjusting to the market, and what they're doing that is nefarious. And obviously, since Donald Trump started talking about this, it sort of smells like some bad stuff's going on. But there is stuff that goes on all the time in terms of adjusting to the market.
So Camille Matilda is picking up on a point that you made on the possibilities of voter suppression associated with mail ballots. So she wants to know, what is the best narrative for combating voter suppression, especially associated with mail ballots?
So, you know, I do think that the best way to manage that is for states to make available drop-off points that are, you know, accessible to everyone, so that have a variety of different opportunities to drop the ballots off early or on election day. Also to ensure that there are adequate polling places that, you know, Elaine already alluded to. Get, you know, understand your state's rules and vote early. And if you're really worried about mail-in ballots, you know, vote in person. And I think that's the best way to think about it. So, you know, one of the things we have to remember is that in places where voter suppression has been a sort of endemic problem, people know how to manage that. And they'll wait in line, you know, 7 or 8 hours to cast their vote. They will make sure that they are there voting. And I think that same kind of vigilance is going to be important to combating any manipulation that might be happening.
Okay, Elaine, Sue has a question. What role can private companies play in ballot delivery? FedEx, UPS, and otherwise?
Well, you know, I mean, this is, I'm sure they won't like this idea, but, you know, FedEx and UPS could decide to charge 55 cents, the price of a first-class stamp, to deliver an overnight package, as opposed to the, you know, $26 for delivering an overnight package. I think people would be delighted to do that. And people who'd sort of forgotten to return their ballot would love it, because they could, you know, go to a FedEx office and for the price of a stamp, you know, get their ballot delivered. Not everybody can afford to spend $25, $26 to get their ballot delivered. And there's a lot of states, some of them, by the way, swing states, that don't count ballots received after election day. So if you're in one of those states that isn't going to count the ballot, it would be kind of nice if the private sector did that. I'm not sure that they would, but it's just an idea.
I would add to that, if the private sector were to get involved, and I'm not sure that they would, you know, you can also get verification that your ballot actually arrived. You know, there's tracking and all that kind of stuff, which I think, you know, might help assuage people's concerns as well.
Okay, there's a question from Kayla. How might the U.S. Postal Service vote by mail issues that we've been discussing affect rural Native American communities who already have limited access to both mail and polling places? And she goes on to ask, what can or is being done to prevent effects on these already underserved communities?
So, you know, those communities are chronically underserved. I don't think there's likely to be a change, unfortunately, in that. And I do think that those communities know how to manage those situations. So likely what it will mean for many of those communities is, you know, trying to get those ballots early, making sure that they're in, they can drop them off or, you know, postmark them relatively early. And then for them, because they're chronically underserved, they're going to have to do that earlier than everybody else. So there are going to be some complications there. I think that's absolutely true. And then, you know, the day of the actual election, you know, lining up early and getting in there. And I think that's, those are sort of the cures, so to speak, for chronically underserved areas, which, you know, is really unfortunate and actually incredibly appalling in this day and age.
Okay, Chanel has a question. She is wondering if we should worry about fraud at the hands of postal service workers. It's a provocative question.
We've never seen fraud at the hands of postal service workers. We haven't seen it in the past. I'm not sure we would see it now. Remember that that when you submit an absentee ballot or vote by mail, there's your outside envelope, and inside of that envelope is yet another envelope almost always where it has the ballot in it. You know, I mean, I guess the postal service workers would have to be pretty savvy about where votes were coming from in order to try to, you know, fraudulently count some or not count some. We've never seen it before. All we have seen is quite the opposite, which is postal workers going out of their way to take ballots out of the mail and make sure they were delivered as first class mail. So we've really seen the opposite. We've seen them acting in the civic interest. It would be too bad if anybody did that. And I suppose it's always possible, but we haven't seen it before.
Yeah. And they're voters also, you know, the postal service workers.
Okay. Heather has a question. She wants to know, in how many states do they ever look at the paper ballots with human eyes as opposed to computers that Heather doesn't particularly seem to trust?
A lot of states do that, particularly if there is some question. In other words, they don't just take the computer's word for it. Those then go to real people, and real people do look at them. And some states don't even have the signature matching computers.
Okay. I have a question about exit polls. So we're going to have votes coming from several different directions in this election. You're going to have the mail ballots, the absentee ballots, people voting early, but in person, people voting in person on election day. How are the exit polls going to make sense of all of these different types of votes? And should we even pay any attention to the exit polls given the complexities of voting in this particular year?
Well, us political scientists, we love exit polls. And we love exit polls because it tells us, we know one thing that you don't know from ordinary polling, that yes, the person actually did vote. I think what I understand from the leadership at Edison Research, which is the big company that does exit polling for television and the major newspapers, is that they started out in the primaries exit polling. They dropped it with COVID. I mean, it just was, you know, a mess. And then in the later primaries, they tried a little bit of an experiment and they set up tables and they had those, you know, those little disposable pencils so that the voters wouldn't have to touch anybody or get close to anyone. And what they found to their pleasure was that they got the same response rate in a sort of COVID altered space that they did in the old days when they were doing exit polling. So they did do exit polling and they plan to do exit polling in the fall for people who are voting in person. The difficulty is doing the polling for the absentee voters or the early voters. If the state keeps a record of it, well, that's pretty easy. You can sample those people. But a lot, some states don't have any record of it. So then you'd have to make, you know, tons and tons and tons of phone calls to find somebody who voted absentee and hope that they're telling you the truth that they actually voted absentee, et cetera. So it's going to be tougher for them to call elections. Plus, there will be no precinct, no key precinct data in a lot of places. The sort of, you know, it's been very valuable tool to watch a precinct or even a county over a period of time. Frankly, I can tell you as a political scientist, jurisdictions just don't change dramatically, right? I mean, there's pretty much consistency in how people in certain places vote. Well, we're not going to really have that because we won't have 100% of the votes in a place. So I think they're going to make it, they're going to try it, but I'm not sure it's going to be as good.
Camille, any thoughts on exit polls?
Yeah, I would agree with Elaine. I mean, I can't imagine those being very reliable this year. It doesn't mean that, you know, pollsters aren't going to try, because it makes for, you know, additional material when you're on TV for hours and hours and hours, and you can just add something in there and then caveat it and say, well, these are the people who voted today. But it will not, I don't think it'll be very reliable at all. So I would agree with Elaine that, you know, it will likely be something that they'll do in some states, you know, some precincts and not others. But that said, you know, I think if you really wanted to do well, you could do it in states where they keep records, but it would be expensive. And I think that alone will keep people away from doing major and robust exit polls.
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank both Camille and Elaine for sharing your thoughts, terrific observations, a lot to worry about. Elaine, you started with optimism. We've now ended up in a situation that, at least to me, seems less optimistic than where we started. But certainly there are lots of issues we all should be paying attention to over the course of the next 2 months. And we probably are not going to know the results on election night unless it turns out to be a landslide election, in which case none of these issues are probably going to be things that we have to worry about. But the closer the race is, the more these various scenarios will become. So thank you for tuning in. Those of you who would like to read more about these issues, go to brookings.edu. Elaine has been writing about this. Camille has been writing about it. I've been writing about it, and a number of our colleagues have as well. So thank you very much for tuning in.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.